Welcome to the Indie Opera Podcast.
We couldn't think of a more appropriate opening to our show than this intro, which comes from 3 days after Evan Mack joined us for this month's episode. It was recorded on the floor of the United States House of Representatives. The voice you hear is Paul Tonko, representative from the great state of New York.
Without objection, the gentleman from New York is recognized for 1 minute.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I rise to congratulate an accomplished composer, educator and music innovator from New York's Capital Region. Professor Evan Mack, recently named a Musical America 2018 Professional of the Year. Professor Mack's first major opera premiered at New York's Baryshnikov Center in May of 2011, an impressive achievement for a first-time composer. Since then, he has composed numerous operas, including a grand opera based on William Kennedy's 2014 novel Roscoe, that received a concert performance with the Albany Symphony featuring Deborah Voigt in 2016. He also co-wrote one of the first ever operas for Twitter, #IsOperaDead, a five-act opera performed in the span of 1 minute and 40 seconds. He also serves on the faculty at Skidmore College and was a resident artist at the prestigious Yaddo. Professor Evan Mack, on behalf of all of your many fans and supporters in upstate New York, congratulations on being named a 2018 Professional of the Year by Musical America. And with that, I yield back.
Welcome to the Indie Opera Podcast. This is Peter.
This is Walker.
I'm Sharon.
I'm Evan.
And in the booth,
Chuck.
Chuck, all right. Okay. Chuck is playing Smeagol today.
Yeah. So it begins.
Yeah. Precious.
So it begins. We were talking earlier that I sound, when I'm recorded, like I've got like a Hobbit filter on my mic. So today we're joined by composer Evan Mack, whose one-act opera, The Ghost of Gatsby, written with librettist Joshua McGuire, will be presented as part of Opera America's New Works Forum January 11th. And we're very excited to have Evan, as well as Sharon Apostolou, one of our wonderful collaborators who's been on our show before. Hello, Sharon.
Hi.
So just letting Evan know that, you know, we're very chill. So just, you know, stand your ground and jump in at any time.
We can edit out anything
stand
you want.
Stand your ground. I can't wait.
Stand your ground because we're just going to attack you. Nonstop.
It's got political really fast.
Yeah. I can already see him tensing up. No. Nothing to worry about.
Peter.
So how's everyone doing? I was just on the Doing the Work podcast. Do you know Math and Ring Black?
What is that? What is Doing the Work?
Sounds very fancy.
Yeah, it is fancy. He does one-on-one interviews with people, various singers, performers. It was really nice. You know, it was sort of like a, you know, conversation, Bill Moyer-style podcast, as opposed to ours, which is like Morning Joe.
Chaos with microphones.
Fox and Friends.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We are the Fox and Friends of opera.
Oh, God, no. We're not.
No, it's more like Kathy Lee and Hoda Kotb.
Yes, amen. That's far more accurate.
But if we are, then Peter Gelb is like listening to us all the time and copying us. And you know.
We'll stop the parallels.
Bye-bye, sponsors. It's been fun.
So normally what we do is we talk about things we have seen at the beginning of the show. And Walker and I went to see something together. And it was incredible. We saw Mephistopheles, the Boito at the Met. And what did you think, Walker?
I loved it. Yeah. I loved it. Yeah. It's a great production by Robert
Carson.
Yeah, and it was really, really, really dramatic. What I love about him is he creates this huge epic world with angels and devils and everything in between. You get glances of heaven, you get earth, and it's just a really very, very intelligent production and very well performed.
Yeah, the sets were by Michael Levine. They were very deep. They sort of covered many things. Mm-hmm. What I loved was the prelude, which was basically one long crescendo, and the the cast very slowly moved to the front of the stage, and then we're singing full voice, and every hair on my body was standing up, and it was, it just blew me away.
It was
away.
Like 45 minutes.
Yes, a 45 minute
crescendo.
It was
like no plot advancement whatsoever, just pure, just right. Here's what we're doing here. We've got angels, we've got devils. And just sort of creating the world. That's all it was.
Right. There was no crescendo interruptus. Yeah. Not at all. It was one
technical
one
term.
That's a technical musical term for our listeners.
Yeah.
Just
yeah.
in case. But it was really beautiful. And Christian Van Horn, out of this world. He's like 6'4". He was basically shirtless for the whole thing. Beautiful voice, speaking directly to the audience. He climbed in on into the theater from the audience.
From the pit.
Yeah. It was really, really amazing. And if you're interested in Christian Van Horn, we had an interview. Chuck interviewed him on our Opera Fixes. Mm-hmm. So you should check that out as well. But yeah, that was a great production. You seen anything else?
That's it. That's all I've seen lately.
Really?
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. Yeah. I saw a little bit of the Philharmonic did a... I have a daughter, and they did a children's performance of stuff by Strauss and other composers. So it was great.
Cool.
Yeah, and they're doing another one by for Janacek soon. So I'm looking forward to that.
Cool. Wow. Yeah. And Evan, have you seen? It's okay if you haven't. But have you seen anything lately? Or
you know, this is going to sound way too self-promoting, but I've been on this sort of mini tour of all of my operas. You know, my children's opera. It's a Christmas children's opera, and so I was
the
in
season.
Yes, so it's based on the Mexican folktale, the Poinsettia, and so I was just got back from San Francisco Opera. They did 6 performances of that, so I got to take my son Carter, who's 9, out there and do a whirlwind tour of San Francisco and do that. But before that, I was in South Carolina at Coker College. They did it, and you know, so it's just like all over the country.
Cool.
So it sounds like all I watch is my stuff, but you know, it's just this month has been that. You know?
It's okay.
It's just the holiday season.
Yeah, that's right. Yes.
I only listen to our podcast.
Yeah, me too.
Let's get the title of that into the air. Lucinda y las Flores de la Noche Buena. Yes. I hope I didn't ruin
that.
No,
that's perfect. Yes.
Which we'll go into more later, but. Anything else? Did you see
this
anything?
This is so pathetic.
Sharon,
but the last
no.
thing I saw was Marnie. I see Folio standing still. A vast immensity. Wait from the rain. The storm is over.
Yeah.
I haven't had the opportunity to see anything else live recently, which is a bummer. And I really enjoyed Marnie. I want to see Marnie again in a smaller theater. That's sort of like what I've been telling everybody about it. Is I really enjoyed it, but I feel like the Met was too big. Mm. And I want to see it in a more intimate setting. I was also like way in the back, which may have been a part of my experience. But I want to pull a mulligan on my Marnie experience and experience it in like 1,000-seat house or 500-seat house.
Right.
Yeah. So
instead of 4,000.
Right. Instead of just seeing ants moving around singing prettily. Yeah.
You should play that part.
Marnie?
Yeah.
I would love to play that part.
I think you'd do that really well.
I just want to wear all the costumes.
Yeah. Because there's something so duplicitous about you. That's just, it's just so lovely. No, you would. You wouldn't play it well. Yeah, sorry.
All right, so now I have a long list of things I've seen. So
good.
I won't linger too long on each one. But first, I went to see New Camerata Opera, who was just our guest. Stan Lacy was on, so I decided to go see something. They did a production because of our podcast. They because we were talking about Kamala Sankaram and stuff, they said, well, why don't we do an evening with her Bombay Rickeys and one of her one acts?
Oh,
so they did an opera,
cool.
An evening of The Enchantress, and it was the first half, which is a one act opera about Ada Lovelace, who was early pioneer in thoughts about computers, back in the mid, I think it's actually the 18th century.
Yeah.
And then her group, Bombay Ricky, did the second half, and they did this whole evening where she came in dressed in as Ima Sumac, and she channeled Ima Sumac for the whole evening. I was so transported and taken away by her. She is such a lovely, lovely performer. And she sang the Queen of the Night aria, the version that Ima Sumac does, that's the jazz version of it. And she did it perfectly. And I just laughed, and it was a wonderful evening. They set up a conceit. Her little band really didn't want to play these things, and that she's obsessed with them. She's saying about, oh yeah, I played the records for the band and they loved it. And the band's looking at each other like, no, we're not really interested in this. And the moment she leaves the stage, the band decides to play something completely different. And she comes in like really angry, and she as a rage, she starts tearing the set apart. She's like taking the drummer's equipment apart, and then she sort of falls into a lump, and they're like, let's play, oh yeah, the Ima Sumac trance thing, maybe that'll make her feel better. And then she sort of really turns into Ima, and she starts singing this like supposed Aztec song, and she starts crawling towards the audience and touching people's heads and stuff. Oh my god, it was so much fun. So Kamala, big thumbs up to her. Also saw The Good Swimmer at BAM. Did you see it?
I saw the original. I saw the one at Prototype. Yeah.
Oh, so they did it at BAM. And it's music by Heidi Rodewald, lyrics by Donna Di Novelli, and it was a Kevin Newberry production.
Yes, I love Donna.
Yes.
She's amazing. Yeah. I love Donna.
I'm not sure the evening made sense, because it was like things
not
are
about that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was sort of like,
it's like a bonus.
Other than that, I had a great time. The visuals are really interesting.
Yeah. I think you just let it flow over you.
Yeah.
It's like an extended, beautiful music video.
Exactly.
And
it's really quite good.
Yeah.
And now I'm going to go through all the things I saw at the Met.
Uh-oh.
So I saw Pearl Fishers. Now, I always assume that Pearl Fishers was something people are supposed to know.
No, they're not.
They're not. They're not. But I keep hearing about...
You know a duet.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of opera that goes around that duet.
But I've always been kicking myself.
Maybe an aria
like,
here and there.
Yeah.
Like, are you super familiar with it?
No, I mean, same thing. It's
same
thing.
A duet,
I know the cliff notes.
Yeah. And they're always topless.
Right.
Pretty much.
Well, that's... can be a bonus. But anyway, so I show up and I open up the program. It's only the 17th performance they have ever done at the Met. So I thought, okay, I don't feel so bad for being an idiot not knowing this particularly very famous piece. And I enjoyed it. I didn't leave going, oh, wow, that particular moment struck me or held me. But it felt like a fun evening, and it wasn't great.
Did you see Alexander Elliott?
No.
He is wonderful, and it's one of those like moments where you're like, your friend is making his Met debut out of nowhere, and you're like, yes, go make your Met debut, go be awesome, we're so happy for you.
I did see Kamar and Nadir as Javier, is that right? No.
No.
It's Javier Camarena as Nadir. I put my hyphen in the wrong place. That's hysterical.
Tenors, it's fine.
And Marius Kuitsian as Zurga, and Priti Yenda as
Layla.
Thank you. Okay. She really reached some emotional places I've never seen her go before. These really interesting womanly sounds with Camarena.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the best singing I've heard from him.
Oh, nice.
So together they were very well paired. I enjoyed it. The thing that, once again, in the Me Too moment, the priest says, you must do the ceremony, and you cannot socialize with men. You cannot sleep. It's like this horrible anti-woman message again.
Yep.
Another
pretty music.
Yeah, pretty music with misogyny.
That's like 19th century opera.
Yeah.
So that's the reason why it's only had 17 performances. Well, probably that's not part of the reason.
I wish that was
no, it's actually true. It's probably not part of the reason.
Unfortunately.
It's like the beautiful music to plot.
Yeah,
not
right.
Quite in its favor.
Yeah.
And then the other thing, of course, was Tritico. I wanted to go see that. Now that was spectacular, of course. Mm. But the thing that stood out was the Soir Angelica, Elena Stidkina, I'm probably going to say that wrong, Russian singer. She only sang that one night. Was unbelievable.
Oh, S. Soir Angelica instead of Opelite. Yeah. I heard she was awesome.
Oh my God. And it was, she sang one night. She sang opposite Stephanie Blythe, who's this powerhouse. Incredible. And she matched it. They sang together the same intensity, volume. Awesome. And I was, the audience went nuts when she took her bow. And I've never heard an audience do that. And like the singer's knees like buckled. You could, she was like totally freaked out by it. But it was, I felt honored to see this debut. And of course, I haven't seen a single thing about it in the press anywhere.
Of course not.
So, but that was definitely like the highlight of the year for me.
Hey, okay.
Yeah.
Love that.
So, speaking of highlight of the year, I wanted to say we're entering a new year. Happy New Year, everyone.
Happy New Year.
And I just want to say thank you to all my co-podcasters and friends in the production. What a great year we had.
Yeah.
And true. Just to remind people, we actually had a wider range of topics this year than ever before.
So true. Yeah.
You know, we had Opera Fit with Ellen Broen starting the year off. We had Ross Crean and Jordan Rutter, along with Sharon, doing the gender non-binary. Randall Angus, Florida. We had Wang Rowe, Royce Vavrick, David T. Little. We did a whole program on women composers. We did a whole program on the Women's Opera Network with Laura Lee Everett.
Yes. Great.
We had Laura Kaminsky. Mm-hmm. We did a really chatty thing about women composers, a whole show of that. Missy Mazzoli and Melissa Smays, Proving Up. Douglas Coleman, Savage Winter. Stan Lacey for New Camerata Opera. And we also had Mental Health last month, which
so
was
good.
Not on. Was so amazing.
Download it now if you haven't yet.
Yes, Ina Dukac and Katie Lindert. And then now we have Evan Mack. So I'm doing the math. Not that I want to do the math, but the math. We had 7 women on. And if we include Evan this year.
Which we will.
Are you a woman?
No.
No. Okay.
The beard.
We're going to count it.
That makes, all science point to know.
That makes 6 men.
How did you get on this show? Sorry, go ahead.
And 2 non-binaries. Yeah. And 2 non-binaries. So our math, we're pretty representative here.
That's great.
It was not on purpose.
Even better.
Yeah.
Even better.
I just did that math this morning thinking, wow. We're representative. Well, I don't know. It's 2% of the... It's 2 out of the... No, I don't think there's that much non-binary. But we have overrepresented the non-binary this one year.
Which is great.
Good.
I'm very proud of
good.
That.
All right.
As you should be.
High five.
High five. All right. So now I want to talk about something even weirder. Remember when we had on Laura Kaminsky and we were talking about As One? And yes. I mentioned this also on the podcast that I did with Mathen. There was a moment in her opera that she played, we played a clip from, where the character discovers stuff about transgender in a library written up in a book. And there's this moment of recognition. And the scene really moved me very deeply. And I realized the reason it moved me so deeply was all of a sudden, I felt like I could identify with an opera character. God, I know that moment. I know what it's like to experience that moment of discovery. And then I realized that's the first time that's ever happened for me in an opera.
Really? And like all of opera.
The
entire canon of the art form.
I've never gone, oh, that's me.
Oh, wow.
I mean, I've had, oh, yeah, I felt that sad or whatever. But I haven't ever really said, oh, my God, that's me. And it got me thinking, how many opera characters, all right, let's go around the room, do you identify with any specific character in opera?
Hmm.
Is there anyone, Walker?
Probably Mephistopheles.
All right.
Yeah. I've always felt an affinity with the devil.
Satan.
No, I mean, now that you bring it up, probably not. I mean, I don't think I've ever seen a character on stage that reminded me of myself.
Or even just the moment, like
I mean, it tends to be like little, like a line on a line by line basis, like in a certain emotion or a certain image or a certain memory or something like that. But a character as a whole, not really.
Yeah,
not really.
Can I ask a question while we're talking about this? Do you find that when you go to like theater or the movies, do you see more of yourself in those characters?
I think movies and TV a little bit more. Mm-hmm. At least I see people who look like me.
Yeah.
Who dress like me, who go places that I go, you mm-hmm. know, who are, might have, might be married, might have right. a child. So I see like the milieu, the sort of the world that they live in reminds me. But yeah, so I would say, yeah, getting theater a little bit, but opera less so.
And books.
Yeah. Books.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
Uh-huh.
So that's, yeah. I was thinking our art form is in a very unusual position because the characters that are often written about are exceptional people who are doing crazy over the top things. It's very we're not giving our audiences that experience of identifying with, I see Sharon's like covering her mouth going,
I have so much to say.
All right, well then say it, Sharon.
Well then I feel that perhaps I think I'm like the sole performer in the booth right now, are not doing our jobs. Because I feel that we as performers should be giving these characters in like whatever situation they're in, the humanity, because that's what people relate to, right? It's mm-hmm. it's sort of the relationships between the characters. It's like if you're, for argument's sake, Rosina, you know, either Barbara or Marriage of Figaro, it doesn't really matter. It's less about like being a countess or a ward of this crazy man, but more about the desire to break through the chains that bind you, which I think is more, or like the life that has been imposed upon you, which I think we all can sort of relate to in a way, and
right.
like loving someone you're not supposed to, big opera theme, that's something we can all sort of relate to. And mm-hmm. I feel like if you haven't seen yourself in those characters, then we as performers perhaps are not doing our job as well as we should.
Are there characters that you've sat back and go, my god, this opera's a...
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Oh yeah,
absolutely. I try to find myself in every single character I do, yeah. or some semblance of myself, mm-hmm. even difficult characters or like not nice characters, although like as a lighter voice soprano, like I don't really play that many mean characters, so it's a little easier. But even like more complicated characters, I always try to find myself in them.
Right.
But when you see a certain character on stage, is there one in particular that you connect with? I mean,
I think it changes. It
yeah,
changes uh-huh. like as I get older and as like my lot in life changes. It always changes. But we should be able to see bits of ourselves
yeah.
in almost
yeah.
every character.
It's true.
Yeah. I'll respond like a lot of times yeah. to the situation, or I remember seeing Flowering Tree and I had a little one at that time, and there was that moment where the character's like, you know, all the limbs are cut, I'm just inching forward in this completely vulnerable being, and I was like, well, there's my kid on stage. You know, mm-hmm. that was the connection mm-hmm. there. Mm-hmm. But in terms of, you know, sort of the bigger art form, I'm usually it's situational or the emotion. It's not, oh, I'm so-and-so, right. you know, right. here or there.
Yeah. It's like something like yeah. as simple as like fellow travelers. Like I am a very cisgendered, straight woman. And yet the end of that piece, when everyone is turning their backs on him, I was a disaster. Mm-hmm. I was just like mm-hmm. weeping uncontrollably because I have felt that sort of rejection. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? From the people that I thought were my friends or the people that are I'm supposed to. Like on some level, I was there on stage with him. Like, I wanted it just, you feel that connection.
Yeah, so
it's not necessarily being,
yeah,
seeing myself
right.
in him, but just, yeah. like, being able, that empathetic tie
yeah. Yeah.
from character to audience.
And this yeah. is where America gave the world the musical.
Yeah.
Which
yep.
is more related, relative, because they're usually based on people that you could be.
Yep.
I mean, there are some, you know, the king, but I mean, he is a kind of screwed up king in King and I.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, if you look at The Young Lovers, that's feasible. Or, I mean, Oklahoma, all of those are people we could relate to. And then as you move forward to things like How to Succeed and the Frank Lesser shows.
Right. But Chuck, who do you identify with? Is there a character?
Yes. You mean an opera?
Yeah.
It would probably be Mephistopheles.
Oh my gosh.
Because
we are so
copycat.
No, because he's having so much fun. He enjoys so much of what he's doing. And he loves playing with people.
Which Mephistopheles are you talking about?
Oh, Boito.
Boito. Yeah,
yeah.
Actually,
way darker.
All right,
darker. Yeah.
But I think it just depends how you look at it. Because, like you said, you know, I think you are doing your job perfectly well. That's why people go to the opera, because they connect with that, and I think people like to feel their their emotional connection on a very high epic level. Absolutely. And I think part of that is because the characters don't look like us, you know, but it doesn't have to be that way. I mean, there's certainly plenty of contemporary operas, you know, where we have that epic arc and it's set in our world. So yeah, it's just a different way of looking at it.
Yeah, and I got caught like with Fellow Travelers, like when I was watching that, I was just rooting for them. Like,
yes,
you know,
exactly.
I just sort of got caught up in that, you know, and then seeing it unfold, yeah, it was, you know, quite tragic.
Right.
You know, but beautiful throughout, you know. So I think that's you know, they were certainly on point and connecting at a certain level, whether I saw myself in that character, not so much. But
I don't think that I need to see myself in a character feel emotionally. I mean, I read Charlotte's Web. I cry over the pig all the time, but I don't particularly.
I knew it.
No. Don't want to be a farmer.
But this is a different thing where you see yourself, like actually see yourself. It was interesting to hear that moment on Within As One and go, wow, I know what that's
next
like.
Level.
And it hit me in a way that just, it was a different kind of an emotional thing than getting emotional watching someone else going through it. I mean, there's a certain safety in watching an opera where other people are going through traumatic things. It's like a safe way to experience other people's emotions, you know?
Absolutely.
But I would felt like I was feeling my emotion. It was really interesting to me. So I was just, it just made me think a lot that I have it in other art forms where that does happen, but it just is so rare in opera that I just wanted to put a plea out there to composers. Hi, Evan.
It's not subtle at all.
No. I'm not.
We want you to make more operas about Peter. That's really what we're asking.
That's great. No, but it also depends upon the production it's given because, I mean, the Barry Kosky Magic Flute, I could easily see. I relate to Tamino and also to Papageno. I mean, but it made the characters very relatable and very human, and what they do when they update Handel.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly. I was just thinking the same thing when you were talking about this, yes.
You know, it's just a matter of how the director and the singers approach it to make that relatable and break through that.
I think part of it is seeing the characters be vulnerable.
Absolutely.
Because I think a lot of times people fall into a trap in opera, and I'm a stage director myself, mm-hmm. so I try to get around this, is of that you have to always be big and huge and powerful. And you know, even if you're this character who's being murdered or being crushed or, you know, is not, you know, is losing, that you're still supposed to be this huge strong force, and I think that's where people that's where people see themselves. So when they see like that moment in Fellow Travelers, you know, where everyone turns their back, when people, you feel that what is happening inside the character, I think people connect with that more. And you know, I think it's in opera, there isn't always enough rehearsal.
Exactly.
There isn't, but you can't blame it on the rehearsal time because it's really a deeper problem than that. It's really looking deeper, like you said, finding things in yourself, in the character, and making it a personal thing, and not just you know, shouting at the audience. I think that's is a big part of it.
I mean, I don't know about you, but I definitely think of Chuck as Papageno.
Yeah,
I accept that.
That's an interesting one, because I feel
Ariel.
Like I am sort of torn between the two of those. I think a lot of times I feel like Papageno, and then other times I feel like Tamino. So you know, I mean, that's one great thing about Commedia dell'arte. If any of you know,
yes.
Commedia dell'arte,
yeah.
You know, they made a concerted effort to cover as many character types as they could, you know, in a very clear way so that everyone in the audience could connect with something. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think opera has taken that on, but it gets skewed sometimes.
Yeah. All right, there I unloaded my emotional baggage on all of you.
You bring up a good point though, because it's, yeah. I mean, As One is one of the most produced operas now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, yes, there's also the return on investment. It's a very inexpensive opera to
right.
do, but
yeah.
I think it part of it is also that, you know,
yeah, that it really
people can
really
see
hit.
Themselves
yeah.
in the characters in a very direct way. Mm. You don't have to like sort of like remove the paniers and the, you know, morning coats. It's sort of like, no, this person is me in a way.
So Evan, when you're thinking of writing an opera, mm-hmm. How does it? Do you think about these kind of issues, or do you just go, "Oh, I found a great story"? Or
yeah, a lot of time. I mean, my radar is always up in terms of figuring out what could be another opera. Usually, it's creating the universe, so there's truths in that universe. So I mean, the wide variety in which we've done, you know, all of the operas I've written, it's always making sure that it functions within this world that we create, and that the characters have to be true all the time. And then you can just peel back the emotion as much as possible. So working with Joshua McGuire, my librettist, we are constantly, when we're laying out a scene, the first thing we do then is the emotional map. You know, what's going to get covered here? What are the things that we're going to take? And so then we can really make sure we're writing in peaks and valleys, you know, arias, duets, something to have people tap in right away. Is there a musical cue I can give so we don't have to say, hey, it's 1920s and we're in Paris. I can give two bars of a Charleston cool. And we're there, you know, so yeah. Things like that. And then to function in that world as much as possible.
So I know you originally started writing operas as both the librettist and the composer.
Correct.
So why did you change the way you work, and has that been beneficial? What do you think about composers as librettists or working with a librettist?
Sure. Yeah. My first opera, Angel of the Amazon, I was both composer and librettist, and I was fortunate. I had access to Sister Dorothy Stang's letters from 1969 to a week before she was killed, and that was essentially the map of the piece. You know, telling her life in a certain way, and the way she even spoke in those letters allowed me to clue in on how to write it, because it started off in very much informal English. And then as her mission progressed, as she was in the Amazon, Portuguese started creeping up in her words. So musically, that's how it is. When she enters the Amazon, she's very Western. And then by the end, she's assuming the Brazilian harmonies and rhythms.
Can you just give the audience an overview of what that opera is about?
Sure. So Angel of the Amazon is about Sister Dorothy Stang, who was a nun from Ohio who worked 40 years in the Amazon working with the poor, and was murdered by hire in 2005 by illegal ranchers and loggers. And she was 73 when she passed away. And so the opera tells her work in the Amazon with the poor people, and having them, poor farmers, live sustainably in the Amazon. And the problem was, she got too successful. They were growing and growing and getting in the way of these people, destroying the Amazon.
First produced by Encompass Opera Theater Encompass in 2011?
Opera. Correct. In 2011, Nancy Rose directed, and at the Brezhnikov, I was very lucky. I didn't know at the time. It was 13 performances over an entire month.
I was like,
oh, this will happen all the time.
First and last time.
And so, but I basically did all I could with the libretto, and I thought, okay, this is, you know, if I really want to do this and run with it, I need a writing partner. And so Josh McGuire went to college with, and grad school as well, and he's a fantastic musician and writer. And I think that's what makes him a great librettist, is he understands that balance between the word and music. And so then we wrote The Secret of Luca, and then Roscoe, and then Lucinda y las Flores de la Nochebuena, and then The Ghost of Gatsby, and now we're on to a comedy. So we're just running
gay
until late.
Yes.
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
Keep doing it.
Yes.
Keep doing it.
Why did you want to, why did you write your first opera, though? What made you think, oh, I should go into opera?
I was inspired. So I've always, composed, and I always was drawn to the theater, and had written some musicals when I was younger, and some children's musicals. And
Were you a performer when you were younger?
I have a couple. So when I did some summer stock theater at the Forestburg Playhouse, which is like where people would get their union credits coming from the
city. Yes. Oh, yes. Right.
And
right,
so,
right.
Yeah, so I was actually I was in South Pacific. I was the yes, I know.
I was an actor before I was a director, so
yeah.
I like
yeah.
I heard of it.
Who were you in South Pacific?
I was the little Eurasian boy.
Nice. For all those that don't know, you should Google what he looks like, cuz he is like I'm looking at like a reddish blonde beard and blue eyes right now, guys.
Yes. Yeah, I know. It was I can't believe that happened, you know. So and then I did the Lost in Yonkers, things like that. So I did plays, you know, and then I started writing. But anyway, so that's what drew me to always the theater. And then when I heard this story of Sister Dorothy, I was actually at a meeting, and they said these gunmen came, and they said, you know, they were hired gunmen. I mean, just two poor men that were given $24,000. And she, instead of fighting or running, she fed them, she blessed them. Said, this is our land. And then they left. And then the next day they had more money, and they came back, and she pulled out her Bible, said, this is my only weapon. Started reading the Beatitudes, and they shot her. And I said, that sounds like an opera. That's literally what came out of my mouth.
Wow.
And so that's what put me on that journey. I said, I'm going to write an opera and tell it, because there was such drama in that one moment. And then reading her story, I thought, there's a way to really cut in, you know, because you can, there were news articles, there was a documentary on her trial, Wikipedia, all those things. But opera could capture the emotion of those moments, and that's when I said, I'm going to write an opera.
So did you have a fascination with opera as when you were young, or where did that come from?
Yeah, so my father is a big opera buff, and so he always had just operas going on in his den while he was writing and things like that. And so that was, I was always exposed to that. It, you know, had seen Tosca at the Met when I was in high school. Susanna when I was a freshman in college. Oh. Yeah, that was my first American opera. And so it was just, it's just great. And so things like that really drew me to the art form. But I always knew, and I was like musical theater growing up, but that was kind of to separate. When I heard the drama of Sister Dorothy, that said opera as opposed to musical. Even though musicals now are getting more serious and sort of heady and everything, it was definitely like that was the real estate in which this piece was going to function.
So you're living up in Albany right
now? Correct,
yes.
And, oh, okay. Nice. Yeah.
And
I was born in Schenectady. I'm glad to see you're working with Schenectady Symphony, right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Yes, yeah, good people.
Do you like working there?
I do. I love it. I love the Albany Symphony and Schenectady Symphony. That's really, really nice. Yeah, I have the sort of the best of all worlds being in suburbia. So, yes, it's very nice.
Are there... Sorry, go on.
I spent 2 summers at Glimmerglass, so Albany was like the great pilgrimage.
Right, yes.
Every day off, you can go to Trader Joe's and the movies and like see civilization.
Big doings.
Yes. Trader Joe's.
Trader Joe's, yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
All our listeners that have been up to beautiful Cooperstown understand what I'm talking about.
Sure, it's middle, it's farmland. I mean, there's nothing there.
Is there much opera in your area?
So usually the summertime. So they'll have, you know, Opera Saratoga and... Glimmerglass, and then for me, my home away from home has been the Siegel Music Colony, which is about an hour and a half north in the Adirondacks, and so they do 5 shows a year, and they've premiered Roscoe with me, and so they're wonderful also because they're working on auditions. So it's Darren Woods is the artistic director, and he really champions new music, and so he'll always put out a call for new arias. And so I've literally driven wet ink up to the colony and said, hey, try these things out, and you know, these young artists will put them in their one of their 5 pieces as they have to have a new American opera. And so,
cool.
You know, it's a good way to get it out there.
So were you sending him music even before you moved up there?
So after Angel of the Amazon, I was connected by Jody Dalton, who's the Times Union critic. And he said, you got to see what they're doing up there. And I'd never heard of it. And at that point, they were in their 100th season. So it was like, oh, you've been here 100 years. And I had no idea.
Cool.
And so, yeah. And so, and then Darren... took me under his wing. I kept sending him stuff. And then Opera Saratoga did Act 1 of Roscoe as part of their season in 2014. And he had listened to the live stream and he had notes. And I drove up and kind of took a lot of his advice. And then they workshopped all of it the following year and then produced it. You know, it was just, it's just been wonderful place. So anytime I have new stuff, it's up there. Yeah.
So tell us more about Roscoe. What is that?
Roscoe, it's an American grand opera. It's based on the best-selling novel by Pulitzer Prize-winning author William Kennedy, who is sort of the Charles Dickens of the Capital Region. Mm-hmm. And he won the Pulitzer and MacArthur Award for Ironweed. Yeah. But Roscoe is about sort of like House of Cards with the Glenn Miller soundtrack. You know, it's okay. Yeah. Cool. So he's the head of the Albany Democratic Party, and he's 55 mm-hmm. and going nowhere. And then his best friend kills himself, and he's got to navigate this impossible future to save the party, save his political son, rekindle a 30-year love affair. So all of these wonderful kind of grand things. And so in the end, it's really about fathers and sons and love and death. Those are the kind of main things that happen. And I knew reading the last page of his novel, he's like, oh, Roscoe steps on the night boat, and there's some prelude about love and death, and it's playing on, you know, clearly describing Tristan. I was like, oh, there's my gateway into the opera.
Is, yeah.
So you, I'm reading your bio, but you said there was an orchestral premiere and a stage premiere. Like, is the orchestral premiere was after?
After, yes, so, yeah, because Siegel is they have a smaller pit, so it was two pianos and drums and a full cast and costumes and scenery and everything. And then shortly after that, the Albany Symphony did it entirely in concert at the Palace Theater. And Deborah Voigt was the star.
Nice.
Yes,
yeah.
It was wonderful. Yeah.
And what do you mean by grand opera? How do you define
it? Right.
Yes,
yeah.
It was. Yeah. So, well, because the first two were, 90 to 100 minutes, Angel of the Amazon and Secret of Luca, and chamber scoring. And this had the full, 39 players, full orchestra, as well as sort of a chorus.
Chorus.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So adding chorus and having five principal roles, five minor roles, and chorus. So I said, we're going to go big or go home with this thing. So that's what we did.
Yeah. So has it been done yet on a big scale, fully staged?
No, so that's the next step, is because it had great reviews with at Siegel, as well as the Albany Symphony Concert, and it was named like Concert of the Year at the time. Mm. It was this really cool happening,
right.
And now it's just a matter of putting it all into place. It's interesting because, once that's off I'm already on to probably one or two other next operas. And so there's an energy in my end to push it and then organically grow. And so even though it's successful, it just career-wise, it made it easier to get a commission for another opera. Mm-hmm. At that end, I'm hoping that as things keep going, then people will say, wow, this is, you know, really something. I mean, it could easily fit in a university setting, with a big program with chorus and as well as really, something like Glimmerglass would make sense New York wise, but really anywhere. It doesn't have to be Albany. I mean, it's really everyone has a father and a son kind of feel, or love and death, and so you're going to connect it at that level.
Covering a lot of bases.
That's right. Yes.
So, you programming directors, if you are listening, there's an opera out there fully ready to be staged in your opera house.
Yes. Thank you.
We're putting it out there. So you mentioned the I'll say it again, Lucinda y las Flores de la Noche Buena.
I feel like you practiced.
Well done.
It was
well
better the second time. Yeah. So now this is a, what size is this?
So this is, this is a four singers and piano or chamber if you wanted to do it in-house. And so Fresno State commissioned it. It premiered in 2016. It's a coming-of-age story based on the Mexican folktale, the poinsettia. And it was designed to either be done in-house or tour to schools. And so the original premiere had 14 schools, over 3,000 kids. And now we just finished the third holiday season. We estimate over 15,000 kids have seen this opera.
Amazing.
Yeah, all over the, Houston, Opera in the Heights in Houston has done it twice, and same with San Francisco. And then colleges and universities are picking it up. There's already three on the docket for next year and probably a few more. And it's great because 98% of the audience seeing it, it's in when they're doing outreach, they're going to underserved areas as well. And so 98% are either Mexican American or Latino American, as well as I'd say close to 100% have never seen an opera before.
Yeah.
And so to see that and hear, tunage, they know it's in a pastoralist theater style. And so it's a theater form that a lot are familiar with, as well as the cast is Mexican-American. I mean, it's just wonderful experience. And so it's just taking off and having a life of its own. And
Josh wrote the...
Yeah, Josh McGuire did the libretto. Tony Radford is the one who commissioned it, and it was developed with the cast in Fresno State. And so we did this like a wet ink workshop and really brought in many pieces of their experience and into the opera itself, because it's a simple story of a folktale where a mom and daughter make a blanket every year for the Christmas offering. Mom's not feeling well. Lucinda has to do it. She can't, and she has no gift to give. And she sees the star lights up these weeds on the side of the road. She picks them up, and everyone's saying, "This is a terrible gift. You can't do this." And she says a little prayer for her mom and lays it on the altar, and it turns into the poinsettia. That's the legend behind the poinsettia. And so Josh made it this wonderful coming-of-age story.
And how did you discover that story?
So that was the premise with Fresno State. They wanted something, and so we had looked at a few things, and Tony had pointed us in this direction. Mm. And it was great. There's things, though, that happened on accident. I mean, when we were saying how to deal with the prayer, and well, obviously be public school friendly, but, prayer about her mother. And I was rehearsing with the group, and Alejandra Tejada, who premiered the role and actually just reprised it in San Francisco, she was talking to her mom on the phone, asking, "How would I say this or how would this in Spanish?" And as she there it was. So like I'm underscoring, and that became the opera. Like it was one of these happy little accidents. Yeah.
Wow.
And so that is the scene in which they're all singing this "Give the gift that's in your heart," and she says this little prayer, and poof, it turns into the poinsettia.
And I saw a little moment where the cast is teaching the audience to sing these little melodies.
Yes, yes.
Which there's this interactive moment to that. Now, was that something that sort of all of a sudden said, "Oh, why don't we have the kids be a part of the performance?" Like, how did that come?
Yeah, there were a couple things. I doing stuff as a child actor. I had done some children's theater, and I knew the interactive component is very big. But we didn't want to go for silly. Having two sons. I knew what type of movies I'd like to see, sort of really went for a Pixar vibe. And so we thought, how could they interact in a meaningful way? And so we teach them the tune inadvertently when she's looking for yarn in the marketplace. They have to sing yarn, and it's the same tune that they'll sing. Later on, he teaches them the tune, "Give the gift that's in your heart." And he says, "Now wait, and, you're going to sing this again." And the moment she has doubt before she's going to put the weeds on the altar, they say, she needs our help, and they all start singing, "Give the gift that's in your heart." So we made it where the kids caused the miracle. Yeah, yeah. And so that was, you know, like, how could we be interactive but meaningful? And so the kids really believe that they, you know, turn this weed into a flower. Yeah.
That's so cool.
Yeah, it's nice.
And so that, now you've moved, was that the most recent one up before the Ghost of Gatsby?
Yeah, so we had the Children Opera, and then the Ghost of Gatsby premiered at Sanford University. Kristen Kenning directed that, and it premiered this past November, and it's a finalist for the Argento competition at the National Opera Association, and then Opera America is going to feature it at the New Works Forum.
Amazing.
Good. So tell us, what is the story?
It's a tale of marriage and madness on the day in the life of Scott and Zelda Fitzgerald. And so this is four singers in chamber opera. It's an hour long, a little over an hour. We actually start with a 15-minute prologue, which is, we call the Fitzgerald Songbook, which is quotes from Scott and Zelda or poems, but in this idea of like, hey, here are the 20s.
First, it's a tale of girl meets boy. Then it begins to chafe and cloy. First, you fall head on over heels. Then find that someone else appeals. Come raise a glass with me. All you who once were free, never believe all that you're told. Love can get old.
And then you peel back the curtain, and we see, you know, the two icons, Scott and Zelda of the 20s. You know, their marriage is falling apart. It's 1924 Paris. And Josh did this really great thing. So it's four singers. It's baritone, two sopranos, and a mezzo. And the three women are Zelda. She was schizophrenic. Cool. And so true to life, actually, Scott trapped her in a room, locked her in a room after their argument. And she tries to get out, and a younger version comes out. And then an older version comes out, and they essentially have the same argument. Scott and Zelda have that same argument, but now it's annotated by all three Zeldas. Mm, cool. And then she dismisses, she tries to, you know, clear her mind, dismisses 18 as a fiction, 18 Lee, the, you know, the younger one. And then the older one, she says, you're the fiction, get out. And she says, no, you're the fiction. And 24 disappears, and we've been in the asylum the whole time. This real like an episode of Black Mirror, sort of the way we're going.
And what is that written for? Is the orc?
So that's a chamber score of piano vibes, drum set, string quartet, and bass.
Very cool. Mm-hmm.
And like real 20s vibe.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, the clarinet is, yes. Vibe, yeah, had a, cool. Yeah. And it was so fun writing the songbook first. Like, hey, here's this cliche 20s and really cool stuff. And then, oh, we thought it was this wonderful time. And it's, wow, there's a lot of things going on behind.
Deeper than that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, is the same cast performing the...
So this cast, what we're going to see is the mezzo who is from Samford University, who sang in Birmingham. She'll be joining us, and then the three. It was workshopped at Siegel this summer as well. So it'll be three singers from Siegel and piano. So
now I may be stupid. I don't know the Argento competition. What? Tell me more about that.
Yeah, so we're a finalist. It's a national competition. NOA does it every other year, and so you present 15 to 20 minutes. And if you win, you get a full production the following year in that city. So if we win, it'll be a full production in Cleveland 2020. So that's beginning of January. We'll be out in Salt Lake and hopefully pay off the judge. No, I'm just kidding. So we'll just, we get judged and we'll see how it goes.
But is it just operas that?
Yeah, it'll be. Yeah, three new operas get to are competing. So you submit and then it makes, you know, it has a committee and they review it and see what makes it. And so we made the finals, you know, presenting our opera. So we'll they also have a neutral group doing it, so you can't bring your cast. So the Southern Utah University is performing ours because it's in Salt Lake is where the conference is. Okay. So you just will, you know, I'll have one rehearsal with them and say faster, slower, you know, louder, softer, and then that's it. You know. Yeah.
Very I cool. did this competition when I was in grad school. A million years ago, when I was in graduate school at the Manhattan School of Music, the conference was in New York.
And okay.
I was one of the singers in it. It was
so you get to participate in the new... Yeah, that's great. Yeah, so you get to... And you do. You meet a lot of, you know, new singers, and it's new to them, too, because not everyone in their opera program is doing new operas, and so it's an experience for them and me as well.
It seems like you're getting some consistent work every couple of years. Are you just really lucky, or... Are you pushing connections all the time? Do you spend a lot of energy on that?
Right. Yeah. It used to be where, right, this idea of, you know, just being holed up in a room and writing and all of that, you know, now it's half that and half, you know, running with connections that you have. So, but now as more operas are happening, especially like with Lucinda and even the Ghost of Gatsby is doing its thing, you know, you just make more people aware of it. So, yeah, but I'm, you know, this is really my career. You know, this is what I'm doing. So I'm focused on it all the time. And so Josh and I are actually working, like I said, a company. It's called Yelton in Texas. And so we have a multi company commission, and it'll premiere in 2020. So we're working on a first draft now. It'll be, again, a one-act comedy, and it's based on a true story where Boris Yeltsin was the mayor of Moscow under the Soviet Union. He made his first trip to the West. He flies to New York. They show him the Empire State Building, the UN Building, and Trump Tower, all of which he was unimpressed. He flies to Houston. Mm-hmm. They show him the Space Center. No big deal. They have cosmonauts. And he made an unscheduled stop at a grocery store in Houston, and it changed the fate of the Western world. He renounced communism. Two months later, the wall falls. 6 months later, he's on the tank shouting, free markets, free markets. And it was because of the Jell-O pudding pops, the variety of Jell-O pudding pops. So the opera takes place in the grocery store. It's a lot of fun.
This is based on a true story.
Yeah, based on a true story. But, you know, the opera is probably going to be three times the length of his visit at the grocery store. But we're making it into all of these
Do you have any references to Nixon in China?
Oh, the opening is completely absolutely the time. Yes, there's a lot of references. Of course, we're, you know, basically making this like 80s retro freakout. So it's, I mean, we're essentially living the 80s. If you haven't, you know, paid attention to all these figures that are in the news, and so it also helps us that Donald Trump was in the news on the National Enquirer all the time because he was starting his affair. Right. So it's essentially U.S. and Russia, but just the 80s. It's great.
More angular clothing.
Do you have comic material in all of your operas? It seems like you have an affinity for that, which not everyone does.
Yes, so no, absolutely. I mean, really, with something like Roscoe, definitely was our first real comedic chops. You needed that kind of release. And even there's a lot of levity in The Ghost of Gatsby, as serious as that is, you need that. And so we're basically, what's nice with Yelton in Texas is, I mean, we really want to reclaim comedy in opera. Because if, you know, it's great that we're in this American Renaissance of new opera, but we need comedy. And so we're going for, like, we're going to plant a flag and say it can be funny and not like, you know, hee-hee funny. Like, it's going to be... You know,
not like no,
yeah, you know, like
we all know what he means, though.
Yes, no, I love that. Right, yes, I love that, though, because I feel like people do go too far. I don't know.
Yeah,
I mean, it all depends what your scale is. But I like that you you're trying to do comedy while at the same time keeping the character development, keeping the interesting storylines, and having more dimensions to it.
Yes, yeah.
And that's because that's what's going to last longer,
right? And they won't laugh if the characters don't have the gravitational pull, and so which makes it very easy if they if they have to have a dramatic moment. That's easy because you've established the characters.
Right.
It's keeping it funny and really perpetuating the joke, you know, for the whole one act.
How many characters are in that one?
This one, yeah. So it's four characters and a chorus of shoppers. So it's eight total. And it's the grocery clerk, the manager, and the rent-a-cop, and Boris Yeltsin.
Do you know what grocery store it was?
It was a Randall's grocery store. Yes, it was at Randall's in Houston. And so we're calling it the Shop and Shop in case we want any grocery store sponsors. But we, of course, we go through a whole list of all the types of names of groceries. I mean, we're just having a lot of fun, almost too much fun. I'm hoping when we put it out to the world that everyone else will laugh, because Josh and I just keep cutting ourselves up. And like, there's like 13-year-olds laughing at all the stupidity that we're doing.
You have to.
So what are the companies you're...
So Opera on the Heights, Alamo City, Texas Christian University, and University of Texas, Brownsville. Part of it was Darren Woods helped connect it through... because he was at Fort
Texas,
Worth, and the Texas connection and being at Siegel, so we're going to develop it at Siegel. And then, you know, just knowing people, Opera on the Heights had done stuff with Lucinda twice, and so... and just making those contacts throughout. So it's just kind of putting these proven products out there, and now it's less of a risk. Plus, I would say Josh and I have kind of climbed up the ranks in terms of writing, and so things like costumes, super titles, orchestra, it's all a luxury, you know, and so we're writing in a sense that it can be done as smart and as economical as possible. So then if there is money for these, lavish things that you're accustomed to see, then it's easy to do. And so, you know, we're always making sure that people can understand the words because we don't know that super titles are going to be there. And as a byproduct, then I write well for the voice because of that, So it's all of those things.
Yeah.
And that's what makes it something like here are these smaller companies can take a bite without, being financial risky, which is always a factor in creating art and opera.
So for the Yeltsin, was that your librettist's idea where did that come from?
We were finalists for HGO had a commission, something Houston based. And I saw this article and I passed and I was like, this is totally an opera. This is just, again, when all you have to do is Google like drunk Boris Yeltsin, and it's just fantastic. I mean, he is just bossa buffo, So it's been a blast, and that was the idea. And so then it was a matter of really just going back and forth as much as possible. And we had a treatment, and then this was the first time really, like usually Josh and I write, we have a general idea, and then we'll lay out the scenes. And this was like, because there were so many interested parties, we had to kind of call our shot a little bit with the treatment and really lay out everything, which then actually some of the best things that worked in the treatment we knew instantly aren't going to work in the opera. And so, I think fortunately, we've only felt ready to write the comedy after writing all of these other dramas. Is the sense of like, we really know what to do here and be as nimble as possible, and that's going to make it a good comedy. And so, and there's these wonderful articles. I even bought there's a book of his former secretary, Yeltsin, that's only in Cyrillic of that account. And so I ordered it through like an old bookstore, and it came and had this wonderful picture of Yeltsin in a 10-gallon hat. And I was taking Google Translate and like getting the chapters. It was just great. So we had some real details on all the different food items that he drew him to. And oddly enough, it was the not all the Americana things like the Lee Press-On nails or the Jello pudding bus, but ultimately he was holding up the red radishes.
It reminded him of home, and
there's bread lines in Moscow, and here he is, and we tell it like a Wizard of Oz where he's essentially Dorothy, and so the ruby red was just too perfect.
I was wondering if do you think Russian audiences would find it as funny as American audiences
find it? It's going to be interesting. I know, because the part we kind of allude to but really can't, that'd be the whole maybe the serious side of it, is how miserable the 90s were for the former Soviet Union, right? But we do essentially say, we do a little epilogue, and he's a flawed human being, and so he had these flashes of greatness filled with buffoonery and drunkenness, so I don't know. I had a Russian piano teacher, and his maybe it was because I was in, eighth grade through high school, studied with him, but he had no sense of humor. So I'm thinking it's just him, but we'll see. We try and give a pass and try and speak to the experience of of what it was at that moment, that what makes America great. And the subtext is the greatness is in the ordinary, right? It's not the Statue of Liberty, the Empire State Building. Yeah, it's the American grocery store that said, you know, this is going to end communism. Communism is a lie, and we need Jell-O pudding puffs.
It's true. I mean, I actually lived in Eastern Europe for a year and a half, in right around 89, 90.
Oh, yeah.
And it's true. When you're... those are the kinds of things that you miss. Mm-hmm. Like, you miss just the little things like marshmallows. Yeah. You know, I mean, it's like nowhere in the world has marshmallows like us.
What? Peanut butter.
Even if you go to New Zealand now, like, they don't have marshmallows like us. So it's like you just get accustomed. That's where the real culture is.
True.
You know?
Yeah.
And it's interesting.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Did you see that movie Death of Stalin?
Yes.
Recently.
Yes, that's
great. That was kind of interesting.
Yeah, that's a real funny one. Yeah, especially the satire there was just phenomenal.
Very black humor. Yeah.
You know, but there's a great documentary too. If you get it's Chuck Norris versus Communism. It's on Netflix, and it's similar.
Wait,
it's
seriously?
It is, and it's how the VHS tape basically helped liberate Romania because they were bootleg VHS. You weren't allowed Western, you know, movies, and so. But it was this, middle-aged woman who would dub these, like, Chuck Norris, and so they loved her voice. They didn't even like watching the English, you know. They watched the dubbed version, and she was speaking the whole time, and it caused, you know, people saw all these wonderful things happening, and they that helped them, you know, kind of revolt. You know?
No, it had an effect. I mean, when I was there, because they had very few channels to take in Western culture. So like when I was there, I was in high school, and so everyone had these cassette tapes of Greece. For some reason, they were all listening to Greece. Because that was what was available. Wow. Or like, you know, like 10th generation Beatles copies. Sure. And then I saw Apocalypse Now. Instead of having, like, even having it dubbed on the film or having subtitles, they had someone up there reading the script into a microphone.
Wow.
Yeah. Like, you know, just like in a monotone. It was so bizarre. Yeah. So, I mean, there is so much there. That's fantastic.
I'm just ruminating on how America's great contribution to cuisine is the marshmallow.
The marshmallow,
That knocked me for a loop.
Yeah.
Tell us about your Twitter opera. Your
Josh and I did. We always it was this lovely marketing stunt. No, it actually for a while it was our most produced opera. We wrote a 5-act opera in 1:40. You know, I think we were actually had a lull in our work, and we said let's try this. You know, because. And
I liked how you phrase it in your bio. You're we found time to write a 1:40 opera.
Yes, we did. Yes, It was. I think I read this a Wired article about a short story writer who he decided instead of writing his next short story, he did his short story on Twitter. And I thought, well, that's interesting. You know, like, and had a few friends, you know, just tweet it out, and that's how the story unfolded. And I thought, well, you know, opera is a very social art form. How would it function in this new medium, you know? And so, and I actually wrote it in a way, it was when Vine was still a thing, in case we had to do Vine videos, that you could loop the 5 seconds until the next one started. But we ended up doing YouTube clips first, and so the tweet was, is opera dead? And I had just 4 friends of mine, and they could, I basically gave them the music and said, film it anywhere. And so the first line, she sings it in a cemetery, you know, is opera dead? And then the other one said, no, opera will never die. And it's in a theater, you know, so, and they're tweeting at one another. And then after the 4th tweet, that was act 1. And then we started act 2, you know, and so it lasted, you know, when you ran through it, it lasted, you know, 1:40, which at that time was 140 characters, right? 1:40. And so, but then since then there were a couple, like CCM did it and a few other places like did it as projects. Yeah, so there's other versions of this, and we thought, if I'm going to be remembered, like, all our work for these long operas, it's going to come down to the Twitter opera. You know, even Josh and I were joking, like, we should take that off our bio now. Like,
you're going to be like John Cage. Remembered for 3 minutes and whatever.
Josh Groban that, like, sang Kanye West's tweets.
Oh, yeah, right. There's something, where you can. Actually, we were just, when I was saying we were in San Francisco, a friend of mine works at Twitter, and I said, where's the bronze statue of us? We were the first. It's like, oh, shit. Yeah. Not true.
Yeah, and I also like how you set the Kennedy, the last passage of the Kennedy.
That's
Can
right.
you tell us about that?
Yeah, that was something I was just totally inspired by. You know, I read that last paragraph, and again, it sort of came off as, I said, this sounds like something that could be expressed even further. And it's just such beautiful poetry in this ruling. And so I wrote that. It took about 2 hours to write. It was one of those. I kept reading the paragraph.
Let's just expand.
Yeah, tell us which ruling you're talking
about.
I'm
sorry. Sorry, Justice Kennedy's ruling on same-sex marriage, you know, to make it legal in the United States. And it's this beautiful paragraph on how no union is more profound than marriage. And he goes from there. And I just felt that, you know, this could speak to so many people, you know, whether you were a same-sex couple or not. It was one of those, I kept reading it over and over again, and then I sat down on the piano and wrote it, and that was it. And so it was, I actually dedicated it to Darren Woods and Stephen Bryant they got married on that date a few years prior when it became legal in New York. And so it became this, you know, this wonderful date in same-sex marriage history. And then Michael Mays championed it throughout, and he sang it with symphonies and in recitals, and then a few other people. Yeah, so it's become this thing, and it was this wonderful celebratory thing during the Obama years, and then it became sort of this kind of protest anthem rally cry, you know, and it's been nice to see the piece function in two different ways.
So I was thinking, when you're writing right now for the Boris Yeltsin, do you have like a singer in mind, or how do you?
Sure. Yeah. No. Well, I mean, to work backwards, yeah. I mean, someone like Tyler Simpson is, you know, yeah, he's totally, just because he's hilarious and would sing the heck out of it. I think I'm drawn to the human voice. I think first, actually, I'm drawn to the theatrical aspect of opera, and so that the amount. How little real estate you can have and pack an emotional punch. And so for me, it actually makes my job a little bit easier. You know, I always worry, like, if I branched out at symphonies, would they be totally lame because I don't have that theatrical thing? Or even when I do write symphonic stuff, I'm thinking theatrically.
Yeah. I was reading about your
Forever Wild.
Forever Wild. Yes, I mean, that's an amazing idea.
Yeah, it was very cool. Yeah, right. So that had, you know, it was guitar, quartet, and orchestra. And then we had a flash mob of guitars in the crowd playing along. And so they became the forest. But again, theatrical, right?
Yeah,
there's a
it's
sense
true,
of that.
It's
yeah.
true. Yeah,
and
yeah,
so,
yeah.
But then that to step off with the human voice, a lot of times my rule of thumb is I'm not a very good singer. And so if I can remotely sing it, then I know that it's going to sit well and everything's going to be clear. And then they'll all take the reins and do it wonderfully and dramatically. And some of the best workshops I've always had is where the singer is teaching me something new about the piece that I never knew
awesome.
Happened. And then how to run with it, how to maximize that as much as possible. I always joke that I'm the middle child, so I'm always trying to please everybody, and so I'm always rewriting in a good and revising. But it's those instances where you see that spark and you say, what can we do to make this absolutely possible?
I think that's a great quality that I think that's really unique that you have. You seem like you're very attuned to people around you. I mean, not only your collaborators, but the audience.
Yeah.
And that's unique, because we talk to a lot of people, and it just seems like a lot of composers like to sort of lock themselves up in their room and do it in a very isolated way.
Sure.
And you're obviously capable of doing that as well,
yeah.
But you're aware, you have all these other voices coming in. And
right,
it's
letting
it's
them
cool.
in.
And letting them in,
that's
yeah.
That's the most important thing.
And I also liked how you described the voice as being athletic.
It is
athletic.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is there a reason you chose that particular word?
I think part because I always tell, I mean, I said if you're, I try and tell my students, like, if you're a fan of the NFL, then you should love opera. I mean, it's you're watching the best
it's
of
true.
The best, and this
it's
is
like
what
the Olympics.
It is. It's
yeah.
it. And so there's a sense of, I think, there's a musculature to it, you know, with mm-hmm. that other, and you as opposed to where it is, you know, with microphone, I can't stand, like, this is the best relationship I've had a microphone in today's podcast, because otherwise stay away, you know. And so I love that there's no tech, you know, it's that sense of they could, yeah. And if you're going to write something that has to soar, but then you also have to make something like, yes, you want the orchestra or the piano to support it, but it can't be in a way that overpowers the singer, right? So there's this instant hierarchy and dynamic that you're dealing with. And so when you, this similar to an athlete, right? It's that athleticism of a give and take between two people, the team dynamic versus the superstar and everything else in between.
So apparently he's had great teachers. Speaking of great teachers, Brooke was one of your first teachers.
She
was. Oh. Yes. Yes. Brooke and I went to Vanderbilt University together. She was a year ahead of me, and she was my, I was her vocal pedagogy guinea pig.
Oh,
and
no
so,
way.
Yes.
That's
so I had to learn about head voice and all these wonderful things. Yes. And
did
so.
Did she walk on your stomach?
No,
like
she, no,
Tina Turner's
she was, she was good.
I feel that support.
Yeah. No, she was wonderful and very patient, because I'm a pianist, you know, so I was saying, okay, like, okay, well, just tell me what to do. Like, just show me, you know, and she said, well, you can. It's in your head and you got to do this. And so it actually was this wonderful memories in undergrad where she had to present me to the class, and look what I did to this specimen. And so what was funny, though, I had I sang a little bit and I cracked, and I smiled when I did it, and there and both her and her teacher said, that's how you get the head voice. And then I was hitting A's and B's. Like, I walked out, you know, to where other voice majors were like, oh, look at that piano singing A's and B's. You know, it was wonderful. Like, yeah, but it was this great, like, happy little accent. And I started laughing because I messed up. And then, boom, it all happened.
Maybe that's why you have humor in your opera.
Yes, maybe that's it. Yes, there was
gave you the A.
Yes, that's
it. So Brooke didn't walk over you. She walked all over me. Doesn't she do that with everyone?
That's just in the podcast.
Oh.
So you're not a guitarist. I was wondering because of the whole guitar mob thing.
Right, yeah. So actually, Josh McGuire is a guitarist. And so a lot of the things I was running by him, and then my colleague Joel Brown at Skidmore, I kept running, you know, again, this idea of like, hey, this is the group you have to work with or, you know, you're supposed to work with and make it happen. And I wanted to make sure it was going to work. And so I, you know, did the best I could. And then again, how would it look, you know, what makes it idiomatic? And so that all came from, again, working with singers all the time. It's like, well, I could do this. Or if you did it this way, it would be much clearer. It's like, oh, let's do it that way. And so that was a lot with the writing the guitar piece.
Okay.
Same thing. Yeah. So other than that, no, it was, I always wish I was like, can't you guys be louder? You know, that was, but other than that, it worked out.
And how did you, tell us a little, even though it's not opera, us a little bit about the Forever Wild thing. So I think that's, seems like something you're very passionate about. Are you a naturalist?
Yeah, no, I mean, I've always appreciated nature and everything. Yeah. And so the Adirondacks, Forever Wild, is their motto. And so, it was this idea of both something could be, it was something that was destroyed and then rebuilt. And it's actually, the Adirondacks is this amazing symbol of the struggle between metal and wood. And I thought, well, there's the guitar. Mm. And so that was the idea of writing for the guitar to be the symbol of the Adirondacks. And then the idea is depicting the destruction and then this sort of seed of rebirth. And by the end, the guitar mob, they fit in, they had to learn a couple chords. And as the orchestra is building, the guitars started, well, it whittles down to nothing, and then you hear the guitars in the audience, like the trees, and then the trees become the forest, and then everyone in this sort of big climactic ending where everyone's playing in the audience and playing in the crowd, and everyone's sort of surrounded by the forest.
Wow. Yes. That's amazing. Really cool.
So very theatrical.
That's such a great idea. That's amazing.
So if they want to learn more about you, where should they go and tell us about what's coming up for you.
Sure. So evanmack.com will be has updates and connected to social media. The Ghost of Gatsby will be touring in Alabama and then done at the New Works Forum. And then look out for 2019 workshop of Yelton in Texas, and then 2020 and 2021 world premieres.
All right. Oh, very cool.
Yeah.
All right. So now I know you have to go. So let's do our once round before the end of the show. Do you have anything you would like to put out there? Things coming up for you or things you want to see?
Things I want to see. I'm going to throw it over to Sharon.
Oh, wow.
I saw you throw it.
Like literally threw it to me. What I'm doing, speaking of upstate New York, I'm doing a three penny opera with
Syracuse Opera.
Oh, very excited about this, as do I. Yeah. Huge Kurt Vile fan, so I'm excited to.
What are you playing?
I'm actually playing Jenny.
Oh, cool.
Wow.
Yes, so not an ingenue, but I get to live my Lottie Lenya dreams. Pretend to be a mezzo. Very excited about that. Yeah. But what I'm excited to see is actually Pelias.
Oh yeah, it's coming out.
I'm excited because I'm sort of a New Works junkie, and so I actually can't wait for the New Works Forum to see all of these, whether they're in small presentations. The Falling and the Rising is a really cool piece. Saw that at Siegel, and they're going to do it during the New Works Forum as well. Zach Redler and Jerry Dye, very very cool piece. And so that I'm looking forward to celebrating with composer friends alike and seeing some new works, but especially that work.
Yeah, New Works Forum, also Prototype Festival.
Yes,
obviously.
Prototype.
That's what I'm looking forward to. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. January. Yeah. It's so chock-a-block with new stuff. Mm-hmm. I know.
January is like Opera Month in New York.
I know. So there's plenty to see. So I'm gonna finish with a slightly sad note. My mentor passed away. I just wanted to give a shout out to all the people whose lives were affected by Harold Farberman, just to give the best wishes to his family. They're dealing with his passing. He was a great influence on many conductors. He taught Marin Alsop. He taught a lot of great young conductors. I just want to say my thoughts are going out to Harold Farberman's family, Corinne, and everyone. Chuck, do you have any last things?
Why, Chuck? Yes. I'm going to be seeing the new Traviata at the Met, and I'm seeing Adriano Lecouvreur, and I am going to see Justin Vivian Bond's holiday show at Joe's Pub.
Oh, cool.
Because it's the best way to bring in the holidays.
Yes,
nice.
It's truly transgressive. And I'm also going to finally see Lifespan of a Fact.
Oh yeah.
At Studio 54 with Cherry Jones, Bobby Cannavale, and
Daniel Radcliffe.
Okay. Yes.
Harry Potter. I mean,
yes.
He's swimming through his
mind. He can't escape it.
But I would recommend for people to go and see Boy Erased in the movies The Favorite.
Yeah.
And
I can't wait to see
Ben
that.
Is Back, which is another Lucas Hedges movie. Mm-hmm. There's also Beautiful Boy, which is Timothy Chalamet and Steve Carell, and Welcome to Marwen. There are a lot of amazing movies coming out.
Thank you so much for being on our show, Evan.
This is great.
It's really
a thrill. Thank you, guys.
Very excited to have you, and can't wait to hear more about what's going on with you. And everyone should try and make it to the New Works Forum, and check out opera on Twitter.
Yeah, it's a cool. He has
he
a
doesn't
cool,
want to be
really cool website too.
Like,
check out Evan's website. Yeah, it is. It's a very cool website.
Thank you.
I really like
very,
it.
Thank you very much, yeah. And Happy New Year's, everybody.
Happy New Year.
Holidays.
Give our regards to Schenectady.
We hope you enjoy listening to the Indie Opera Podcast. Could you do us a good one and give us a review on iTunes? It's a free way to show your support. And if you're not already subscribed to the podcast, please subscribe to us in iTunes or other favorite streaming service. That way we will be automatically sent directly to you. If you want to help change the face of opera, please go to patreon.com and become a supporter. And if your company wants to reach a creative, passionate, and dedicated audience, please consider advertising on the Indie Opera Podcast. This episode of the Indie Opera Podcast was recorded at the National Opera Center and is produced by Peter Zepp with co-host Walker Lewis, Sharon Apostolou, and our special guest, Evan Mack. Our show is created with the support of Brooke Larimer, associate producer Chuck Sachs, Ross Crean, who created our theme music, and recording engineer Ben Young. This episode was edited by me, Peter Zepp. Thank you for listening.